You're tuned to Eastside Radio 89.7 FM, and I'm delighted to welcome our guest into the studio today, the clever and creative Annie Luby. Annie is a Gestalt psychotherapist, counsellor, and facilitator of the Hoffman Process. With a background in the arts, Annie is also an accomplished and award-winning actor, producer, and teacher of over 30 years' experience. The arts have been a major factor of Annie's life, and she has unwavering belief in the power of creative expression as a healing force. Whether it's music, art, theatre, or literature, Annie loves the human capacity to create meaning in all expressive forms. Annie is also a parent, wife, daughter, auntie, sister, and friend to many. Annie Luby, welcome to Eastside.
Thank you, Chris. It's a lovely introduction. I don't know if I can live up to it, but it's lovely to be here with you.
We'll see how we go. So mindfulness is a somewhat ubiquitous term these days. It can mean different things to different people. What does it mean to you?
It means many things. I guess I frame it more as awareness broadly. And you and I kind of connected over one of our favourite teachers, Eckhart Tolle. And he's probably had the most profound effect on me in terms of what mindfulness is or how I can bring awareness to the present moment. So for me, I have less of a structured practice and more of a practice of awareness in every moment.
And there's a quality to that awareness. Ramdas calls it loving awareness. So it's kind, gentle quality. It's awareness can be a heightened sort of anxious state, but the awareness that we have as part of mindfulness is a more nurturing. Do you have thoughts about that?
I do, but I think that one of the greatest qualities I like to play with is curiosity. And so sometimes in my present moment awareness, there's anxiety or there's uncomfortable feelings. The awareness of the feeling or of the thought or of whatever's showing up gives me a little bit of a kind of a separation from it. So if I'm aware of whatever the feeling is, then I'm not completely it. So I'm very drawn to modalities like internal family systems, which looks at the kind of inner village and internal parts, so that I can frame it as a part of me feels anxious or a part of me is joyful or a part of me is scared shitless. And then I can approach it from a place of loving awareness. Yes. So, but it doesn't preclude difficult feelings is what I'm saying.
I guess. Not becoming cut off from your feelings. It's feeling the feelings, but having a spaciousness around them. Is that how you'd describe it?
That's exactly how I describe it. Is awareness for me is like being the kind of witness of my own movie, if you like, of what's going on in any given moment. So then I'll be going through my day and I'll find sort of punctuation pauses where I can stop and bring my attention within and just with a sense, this sense of loving curiosity of what's here now, what can I meet in this moment, even if it's challenging, where can I meet that with acceptance and I guess a sense of, I keep saying the word curiosity, but that for me is like an open exploration of this particular phenomenon.
Well, curiosity suggests that you're looking at something with fresh eyes, that you're bringing an awareness to it that's different than was five minutes ago. When you're not just assuming, well, this is the way things are and they're going to continue to be this way. And it makes me think of Ellen Langer's description of what mindfulness is, which she says it's active noticing. And what we need to be doing throughout the day is actively noticing new things about your environment, about the people that you're with. And so it keeps things really fresh and energized. So if you're in a relationship with someone and you see them every day and you're used to a particular way of operating, you're trying to bring a freshness and that curiosity to it. And that makes you feel it's a very awake state.
I completely agree. And it speaks to what the Buddhists call a beginner's mind. So yeah, that's absolutely it. Because I think our conditioning and the things that we bring from, you know, that are kind of rooted in our family of origin, the condition, behaviors, and beliefs are a kind of truckload of assumptions that we hold about the world, about other people, about ourselves. And being able to question that, to sort of remain open to the possibility that they are old programs that we've been carrying around, and to bring a sense of you know, that curiosity and just generally questioning, I wonder if that is actually true. And one of the things, another favorite teacher is Byron Katie, where she's these wonderful four questions. She's got a beautiful book called Loving What Is. But being able to go into the inquiry around any given scenario and asking these four questions around it, around the truth of it. And it doesn't mean that what we're experiencing, thinking or feeling isn't real, but real doesn't mean true. So to be able to bring that sense of, you know, what is true here? What if it's not true? What if I question that assumption and in this moment go, who am I without that? It's very liberating.
I love those Byron Katie questions. So the first one is, what do I believe to be true?
It's really simple. The four questions are, is it true?
Is it true? That's right.
And in some ways, that first question doesn't really matter what the answer is. You could go, yes, it's absolutely true. Whatever the assumption is that I'm holding, yes, it's true. That's okay. You can, you know, that's okay. Because the second question is, can you absolutely know for certain that it's true?
That's my favorite. How do I know it's true? And then you try and stack up some evidence. And once you start trying to put that evidence in place, you're like, maybe not so true. And that's when you get that moment of laughter, you know that you're just shifting out of that fixed mindset, and it's a lovely place. And then is the third one, what if the opposite were true?
Well, the way that I work with it, and I could be, I may be not using it strictly as she does, but I ask, is it true? Can you absolutely know for certain that it's true? And that also can be, people I work with can be like, you know, yes, I absolutely know it's true. The third question is, what is the impact of holding that as a truth? I say in inverted commas. What does it cost you? What does it feel like in your body to hold that as a belief? Let's say the belief is no men are trustworthy. That's a belief that I absolutely hold. What's the cost of that? How does it feel? What's the contracted state of that particular belief? Because it's just a patterned belief, yeah?
And what does that bring into your world? What do you filter through that belief that gives you your outcomes?
Yeah, what does it do?
Proves that for you.
Absolutely. What does it do to you? What does it do to your relationships with yourself and with other people? How does it impact the field that you operate in? The third question is a really big inquiry into, you know, what does it mean to hold this particular belief? And then the fourth question, which is just beautiful, is who am I without that belief? And sometimes I'll take someone through a process of being able to just see the belief in a little soap bubble, just to see it hovering there. And just as an experiment, even with the spirit of playfulness, even, is to just sort of pop that belief and just watch it dissolve and then feel into the space that exists in the absence of that belief. So then who am I without that belief? And it's beautiful watching people play with that, because invariably it's, oh, I'm, you know, they say words like freedom or relief or lightness.
Yeah, it's a heart-opening exercise. It sort of allows you to drop that protective guard that many of us have up in particular situations or frequently, you know, depending on what's going on for us. And it allows you to peel that away a little bit and open into something deep.
It's definitely a deepening, and it can be hard. It can be, people can experience whatever that spaciousness is in whatever way is true for them. But it's a great thing just to question, you know, it's the big spiritual question, really, isn't it? Who am I? The I am. And you know, without that limiting belief, then who am I? It opens up a whole lot of beauty and spaciousness. Then they're the four questions. And then the last part of what she talks about is the turnaround, which is what is the opposite to that is equally, you know, true or you can play with. So if the opposite is of all men are not to be trusted, for example, the opposite may be, well, maybe I'm not to, you know, maybe where am I not trustworthy? Often we're projecting a whole lot of stuff onto the world that we don't want to look at in ourselves. Or it may be, what's it like to hold a belief that men are good and trustworthy? What does that feel like? How can I explore that in the same way, you know, as a belief that I might hold? And how does that impact me?
Yeah, fantastic. And once people unravel that particular question that they work with, how hard do you think it is, or how easy do you think it is, to maintain that fresh perspective, that fresh view?
It's such a great question, because until we've really started to work with those deep, imprinted, conditioned beliefs and behaviours, that they're like the default mode network. So they quickly kick back in, because they are our survival sort of strategies that we've developed from a very young age to protect us, not in a particularly functional way, from being hurt or from taking a risk. Or so one of the models that we work with on another piece I do called Love Code is a beautiful model, which is three concentric circles. And the outer layer is protection. The layer in closer to our center is the wounded layer. And then in our center, obviously, is our sort of true nature, if you like, our essence.
And in that Love Code process or program, you're working through those layers to get to the essence. Is that right?
It's a very simple model of self-inquiry, because we're born, you know, essentially good, and we're not born with any of the limiting beliefs and patterns. We tend to take them on very early on in our family of origin. And we also have a whole truckload of unmet needs in every family. There's no parent on the planet that can meet all their children's needs. So this is part of human nature. It's not, and there's a spectrum from, you know, neglect and abuse right through to a whole lot of unmet needs. So yeah. In that layer, which we call the wounded layer, is things like shame, fear, mistrust, insecurity, the hurts, those, you know, things we don't want to feel. And in this work, it never fails to amaze me that all human beings are programmed not to feel the uncomfortable feelings. So we spend our lives trying to move away from them. And that takes us into our protective layer. But of course, in doing that, we're moving further and further away from our true nature, from that place of center, of lovability, of, you know, a connection with, you know, nature and goodness. So it's counterintuitive to work back through the layers, because it means we have to sit in the place we don't want to feel, which is the more uncomfortable feelings.
The discomfort. And that takes some emotional courage.
It takes courage. It takes willingness. And a lot of people come to this work in midlife, where, you know, they've got to a point where it's like, oh God, I'm still doing that same bloody thing. You know, the same patterns are playing out in my relationships, in my work, and, you know, in my self-sabotaging, in my opinion of myself, and, you know, the same. And people get to a point where they go, something's got to give here. So people come to this work when they want to change and grow and deepen.
Or evening friends, here's your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. It's that love in need of love today. Don't delay, send yours in right away. Hey, going round possession, and it will if we let it destroy everybody. We all must take precautionary measures. If love and peace you treasure, then you'll hear me when I say, oh, oh, that love in me.
Arts Monday on Eastside Radio, and you're tuned to the Art of Mindfulness program, where I'm chatting with Annie Luby. Annie, can you tell me how you discovered mindfulness meditation practice? Where did it come from?
Well, I think I was like you. I think I was on a yoga retreat, actually. I wasn't that much into that sort of thing. I was into it more, actually, from an exercise point of view than from a spiritual point of view.
Yoga's the gateway.
It was, yeah. And I remember lying there in Shavasana, having exerted myself, you know, a lot, and being in a state of you know, kind of blissful presence, and thinking, oh, right, that's what they mean by this, that this sort of sense of real presence, of being completely there. And then one of the teachers started reading from a book, and at that point I didn't know what the book was, and it made so much sense to me, this book, this passage that he wrote. So he read out, and it turned out to be Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth, and I thought, I have to read that book. So that was kind of the beginning. And then another beautiful mutual friend of ours, also in the arts, who I went to NIDA with, Sansia Robinson, sent me a CD of Eckhart at Findhorn, and I listened to Eckhart, and so many pennies dropping, and it was really, that was a big shift in my way of being, I think.
If you had to sum up what Eckhart Tolle teaches, could you do that? It's pretty hard, isn't it?
No pressure. I'd say read the book. No, Power of Now is a wonderful book. The one that touched me the most, though, was A New Earth. I think the simplicity of his teaching around meeting the present moment, like the deep knowing that this moment is all there is, like right here, right now, and we live in a world that is so future focused, or we get caught up in past rumination, and the practice of really simply meeting this moment and accepting it just as it is like a kind of vertical dimension, as opposed to this sort of surface horizontal reality, if you call it, that most of us are conditioned to think is life.
You actually introduced me to The Power of Now. I remember vividly the day that you suggested I read it, and it had the same profound effect on me. And I was doing a bit of meditation, had been for quite a few years, but I read that book, and the first line, I think, is, "The beginning of freedom is the realization that you are not the thinker, that you're not your thoughts." And I had been, and probably still am, someone with quite a busy, active mind. And it was just like, it was like someone switched a light on. It was absolutely extraordinary. And then we went on a retreat with Eckhart, which was fun and hilarious. And I want to ask you about that actually in a moment. Maybe I'll just ask you now, how important do you think humor is in the journey of being present, being mindful?
Oh, I was going to say exactly the same things. One of the things I love about Eckhart is that he's really funny. And when I listened to that CD that San sent me from Findhorn, initially I was like, you know, very serious and reverent and, you know, in my inquiry. And then he started to make me laugh. There's a lightness in his teachings. And I think in all true spiritual teachings, there is a lightness. And I think humor is incredibly important, because our thinking and often our feelings of that kind of, what we call it, Hoffman process, the sort of, we call it the shitty committee, actually, often. It's this sort of push-pull busyness, our ego structure tends towards being very serious, that we've got problems we have to solve. And the deeper inquiry actually opens up a lot of humor, because life's nuts. We're nuts.
Yeah, I noticed that with all the really profound teachers, is they're funny. They put the light in enlightenment. Yeah.
I like that. I haven't heard that. That's cute.
I just made it up.
Did you?
Yeah. So that Eckhart retreat, it was pretty interesting in that it wasn't like sitting and meditating for hours. It was just really listening to him speak, wasn't it? And do you remember when Tami Simon did the introduction and it was, the room was silent?
I've been lucky enough to see Eckhart a number of times, and of course you know, normally in a big, you know, 600 people in the room or whatever, and Tammy invites people to just be quiet, to greet him with nothing other than their presence. And he's a funny little guy, kind of toddles in. He's very, very unassuming and incredibly humble. And also having been in closer proximity to him, there is not a whiff of ego about this guy. He's just incredibly light and present. And it's a very unusual quality. And we're very drawn to it because it's so non-judgmental. There's nothing about him that comes with any flavor or hint of any kind of criticism. He's just completely accepting of the moment. So it was beautiful because everyone just greeted him with silence. And then he sits down and he kind of looks at people and kind of nods with his funny little smile. And it's quite an extraordinary presence that he has.
Yeah, it's a very Zen approach, apparently, that he doesn't plan anything. He just sits and speaks. And what I think is really interesting is there's no dogma. There's no you have to think this or you have to believe that or you have to worship this particular entity or other. It's just be here now, really, isn't it?
It is. And I think that I'm drawn to lots of different teachers. There's so much we have available to us now. We're so lucky. And I'm drawn to those sort of non-denominational inquiries that are not rigid, not rule-based, but that are inclusive and kind of there's a flexibility in the inquiry because each individual comes with their own constellation of inner parts and wounding and patterns. And so part of the journey that I'm in myself, but also that I hope to do and do guide other people into, is this sense of self-responsibility, of really, really taking full responsibility for who I am in the world and what I bring to the world.
Yeah, I love that approach. And in fact, I had a conversation with you recently and you said something really wise. I said I was upset about something or we were talking about something and I said, but I know it's my stuff. And you said, it was so great. You were like, yeah, well, we just have to clean up our own mess and then everything else is fine. Like if we clean up our own stuff, then everybody else suddenly starts behaving in an appropriate way.
Not always the case, but all we can do is take responsibility for our part in it, in whatever we're co-creating in a relationship or in the world. All I can do is fully own and take responsibility for my part in it. And that's around, you know, having healthy boundaries of being able to discern what's mine, what's the other's, and, you know, being able to hold difference. I think that's one of the beautiful things I keep encouraging people to do because we want to go to the binary of right and wrong and black and white and they did this. And rather than being able to build a more mature capacity to hold difference because we are different and people are going to have different ways or opinions. Where can I allow that person their experience but hang on to my own as well? Not in a rigid way but in a way that includes the sense of inclusivity.
So important at the moment with what's happening in our culture that is sort of moving towards dividing people and you're either on this side or that side. And I know there's a party in the US called the Forward Party and they're not about left or right. They're just about let's move forward and we can hold different opinions and this way find peace.
And peace starts within. I often say to participants on the Hoffman process that it's an inside job. So the journey to peace, the journey to coming back and into healing in my own wounded layers is my deep sort of process back home to peace. But I think we have to embody that and have a sense of that within ourselves before we can then take that out into the world.
So how in the Hoffman process sort of practices do you do with people to come back to that, to your home, to your center, find that peace?
It's a big, deep dive. It's a week-long residential process and it's very immersive and very experiential. It's been around for more than 50 years. So it's beautifully structured and there are various ways that we go into the inquiry. So we can work from the outside in and from the inside out. So there's lots of different practices. Some of it meditative around visualizations of getting in touch with what is our true nature. But more importantly, what's in the way of our access to our true nature, because all of our limiting beliefs and behaviours are the blocks to love. They're the things that block us from connecting with who we really are, and they're our sort of survival strategies from childhood. So it's a beautiful journey back home, but it's kind of paradoxical because the very place we least want to sit is where the gold is. So it's a process of peeling back all of the layers of defence, which takes us closer to the place that's painful, in order that we can love ourselves through that to come back home.
So there's a little alchemy that happens with the muddy muck that we have to wade through, and then we turn that into gold. Is that the idea?
I guess so. You can. It's the analogy also is the lotus flower, you know, blooms in the mud. Most of us don't want to go there because it's, you know, it is painful and it is courageous work to go into this inquiry, but it's really beautiful as well, because ultimately we get to reparent ourselves or to come into a place of really mature self-responsibility, of self-love. We're the only ones that can do it, you know. I think a lot of people stay in that place of blame, and that's where the vindictiveness lies, in, you know, hurt people hurt people. And that if we stay in that place of victim blame, then we just stay there. We're in that kind of vicious cycle, rather than actually going, I've got a choice here. Am I going to stay in that victim consciousness, or am I going to actually take responsibility for all of the places inside me that have been hurt and love them, so that I can come into a deeper sense of myself, of authenticity, of maturity?
Well, you just answered the question I was going to ask, which is what is the option if you don't do that work and you just stay with your existing patterns? Then what does your day-to-day life look like?
I guess you touched on it before about the divisiveness that is in the world at the moment, which is a broad sort of victim consciousness, victim blaming place where the other person has done something to me. And it keeps, it's a very young place in all of us, that victim place. It's our powerlessness, and we have to blame the other. But in the blame, that's actually that also, Byron Katie talks about that as well. One finger pointing to the other, three pointing back. And so the invitation is to look at, what's my part in it? Where can I move beyond this very young victim blaming place? And so coming back into, where do I do that in my own internal system? Where do I stay in shame and self-blame and self-criticism? That kind of dynamic and vicious cycle happens intra-psychically, intrapersonally, but also interpersonally. So in healing and taking responsibility for myself, it means I can be in the world in a way that doesn't go into reactivity so much as responsiveness. And, you know, beautiful Viktor Frankl, that wonderful quote, between a stimulus and a response, there is a space. And in that space lies our choice. And in our choice lies our freedom, something along those lines. But it's that gap of building enough capacity to be able to pause and choose our response, rather than the hair trigger reactivity that we tend to go into when we're in this kind of immature state of consciousness, which is victim consciousness.
When people do this work, do you think there's a fear to not do this work because they may be different and it's going to change things, their relationship with people? I'm just wondering what the resistance is to people untangling the mental patterns that aren't useful to them.
Again, it's rooted in childhood. So if we're in that kind of immature state of consciousness, then we've got a lot of fear that if I challenge the status quo, if I speak up, then I'm not going to be loved. I'm going to lose my relationships. So yes, people stay in better the devil you know and don't rock the boat and all that kind of thing. They can go many ways. They can go into compliance and pleasing, or they can go into blowing it up, and all sorts of patterns we go into in our reactivity.
Yeah, but then if people do the work, then it becomes sort of a practice, doesn't it? It's not just I do a retreat for a week or I do a practice for a week and hey, suddenly no problems and I just respond really brilliantly to everything. Life keeps coming at you. So we need some things on a daily basis to keep filling up that tank of resilience.
Yes. And when we start, before we came on air, we said something about, you know, shit happens. And it does. Life keeps coming at you. And doing anything, any kind of inner work, there's no magic pill. This is not any kind of cure-all, but doing a deeper process. For me, I love the deep dive. You can go to therapy once a week or once a fortnight for an hour, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, and I certainly work with people one-on-one in that way. But there's nothing quite like the deep dive for a kind of a reboot of the system. Now, that's not to say it's a magic pill, because then the trajectory may shift. That was my experience of doing Hoffman myself, was I had a deep enough experience that something shifted the trajectory. But then it's up to me to then take that bag of tools and apply them in my life. You know, I can, you know, give you the best golf clubs in the world, and if you're not going to learn how to swing a golf club, you're not going to be able to play the game.
Yeah, and also those patterns are ingrained, so it's easy. It is a default mode. And I like to think of it as the sort of neural pathways as long threads of cotton that have knots in them. And when you do some work, you unknot the thread, but there's still a kink in there, and you need to keep smoothing it out, and maybe one day it'll just be smooth and you won't have those mental bumps.
Yes, it's practice. You have to practice who you want to be in the world, and you can practice in all kinds of ways. It can be meditation, it can be all kinds of tools that we can use to stay on a path of growth rather than on Groundhog Day cycles of that are no longer serving us.
Change your heart. Look around you. Change your heart. Will astound you. I need your loving like the sunshine. And everybody's got a line sometime. Everybody's got a line sometime. Everybody's gotta learn sometime. Thank you.
Arts Monday, and you're tuned to Eastside Radio 89.7 FM, the Art of Mindfulness program. And I'm speaking with Annie Luby about mindfulness and creativity. Annie, last questions before you leave today. What is the one difference a meditation practice has made to your life?
I'm really bad at this succinct one thing. I wouldn't even say it's a meditation practice. I would say my present moment practice has given me the gift of space and time to question my reactions.
So what does that look like on a practical level?
Pausing. I guess I call it the pause. So building the capacity to wait, to slow down and not to jump in and react. And of course, I fail all the time. But even in retrospect, I can look at, well, what was that reaction? I can keep growing.
So when reactivity happens, which happens for all of us, do you notice it as a mental construct? Is it something that you feel in the body? Is it different at different times?
Different at different times, but I think the most common thing for me is I will feel a sense of charge or activation in my body. And if that's happening, I know that that's not a great place from which to react. So first of all, I try to come into the body, slow my breathing down, recognize that I've gone into some sort of activation, and wait.
Yeah, I like to track the half-life of those when your body is just really charged. I had a situation recently where a stranger just attacked me for parking in the wrong place, and they were right, but it was a really inappropriate attack. Like, it was a full-on attack, and my body just went like into flight, and I had to drive somewhere quite a long way, but my hands were shaking, and so I tapped into my breath, my breathing, but still the adrenaline charge that runs through your body, and just allowing that to be there and knowing, okay, this is there and this is going to have an impact on everything I do until it's out of my system. So tuning into it, and it's not pleasant, it's not fun, but at least having that awareness is a starting point, and also knowing it's actually okay to have that response when a tiger leaps out at you and starts roaring at you.
Absolutely. I mean, the nervous system is fascinating, and so much of modern therapeutic practice includes the body, because that's a little T trauma right there, and your nervous system gets activated. So having awareness around that, knowledge around that, what's normal, the fact that our bodies shake when we're, you know, activated, to allow that, to slow down, to take the pause, to be able to breathe, to learn to regulate our own nervous systems is incredibly key to our capacity to be in the world in a responsible way rather than being in reaction.
What do you think the role of creativity is in all of these practices?
I think of creativity as coming through us. So the more present I am, the more connected I am, the calmer I am, and the more likely it is that a creative idea will come. That they've been my most beautiful moments of creativity have been not through my busy mind thinking of something, but of an idea coming to me. And that then it's kind of not magical, because it's not magic, but I'm out of the way. I'm getting out of the way. And there's a beautiful Rumi quote that kind of encompasses it all, which is our task is not to seek for love, but to merely seek and find all the barriers we have built against it. And I would say that's the same for creativity. Where am I in the way? So this coming, looking at the barriers, peeling back the barriers, means that I have not only more access to love and peace and wisdom, but to creativity.
Fantastic. That's really beautiful. Another question I'm starting to ask people is, if you had an extra hour in your day every day, what would you do with it?
I've got this little practice going at the moment, because I tend towards being a busy person. I get a lot of things done, as you well know, Chris, and I tend to live a kind of jam-packed day. So what I've started to do for my nervous system, actually, is to take, even doesn't even matter how long, it can be 1 minute, can be 5 minutes, can be 10 minutes, longer if I've got it, is I literally lie down on the floor and I let gravity hold me, and I allow my body to be held by the earth.
That's beautiful, Annie. I also love that you said you could do it for 1 minute or 10 minutes. A lot of people, I think, believe that 1 minute isn't enough to do a practice, but I always say 1 minute is incredibly powerful. A lot can happen in 1 minute. The parasympathetic nervous system can really help regulate your heart rate, your blood pressure.
Absolutely. That and music, singing, humming, like the vibration of your vocal cords and the impact that has on your vagal nerve, being able to, that's incredibly calming to your nervous system. Hum for a minute, see how you feel afterwards. 1 minute, everyone's got 1 minute.
And what about singing? Because I know that you do a lot of singing and you're a beautiful singer, and you've also done some amazing singing workshops with Tony Backhouse. Apart from being a joyful, wonderful experience, do you think there's therapeutic benefits?
I know there's therapeutic benefits. I've done amazing things with Tony, also with Darren Percival, who also does wonderful work in this space. And it's so healthy, not so much about being a good singer, because I don't sing for that reason anymore. I sing for the joy of it. And singing with other people, like singing with other human beings, is a whole other way of connecting to myself, but also to the interconnected field that we create with music. There's nothing quite like it, particularly when there's harmonies. And, you know, and it doesn't, the beautiful thing about Tony and Darren is that there's an inclusivity. So my husband, for example, who was always taught he couldn't sing and has never sung, and it's always just been this thing he wouldn't do.
Or you,
comes to these workshops and chooses to sing. And it's so inclusive and so non-shaming as an environment that it's incredibly healing.
And it's a totally embodied experience. When you sing with Tony, you stand up and you move a bit and you clap and you're really in your body.
Absolutely. It is very embodied and it's incredibly joyful. It's like a high, like so much more than other things we think make us high.
Oh, well, it's been so nice having a chat with you today, Annie, and I'd love to have you back another time to do another deep dive. So thank you so much for coming to Eastside Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's been just a delight. And I know we could talk for hours, so yeah, let's do it again.
My family did. I am not the voices in my head. I am not the pieces of the brokenness inside. I am light. 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 I am. Of it all.